The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by the chair of the Westmorland family, the business behind T-Bay Services in Cumbria and five other similar businesses across the UK. The Unique Services opened in 1972 on the M6 and is more than a mere motorway service area. It is, quite truly, a community hub. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Sarah Dunning. Lovely to have you on board.
Lovely to be here, Daniel.
Now, Sarah, at the beginning of every episode, we ask our guests about inspiration, about what it means, about what has inspired you, whether inspiration is a notion of value that you think is necessary or just pleasurable or just doesn't exist at all. What is inspiration to you?
For me, inspiration is what gives me my positive energy to get up in the morning or to keep at it. That's what I think is inspiration. It's the drive behind the positive that you can do. And for me, I'm in business. I run a business. I think I might not have ended up in business if we hadn't had a family business. But since I'm in business, I'm very inspired by the idea that business has, I think, as much power to do good as almost any other sector, if approached in the right way. And I love that idea. I think it's a really empowering idea. Our business, it's a motorway service area business, but really at the heart of it, it's all about local impact. So allowing our customers to celebrate our locality and enjoy our locality. It's about our local supply chain. It's about our local colleagues. It's about getting involved in our local communities, looking after our local environment. And I think that all creates a sense of belonging somehow. And I think it's a really important aspect of life, is that sense of belonging to something bigger. And I think any business, if run in the right way, it doesn't have to be all about local, but any business run in the right way is part of a much bigger community. And that does create a sense of belonging to something bigger. And that's really nice. We're a food business. That's an inspiration for me as well, because I think I'm at my happiest with food. I love food. Most people hate food shopping. I love food shopping. I love meeting producers at farmers markets. I love cooking. I love eating. And I think there is something about food which, on the one hand, it's a creative thing. It draws on all the senses. I definitely lose myself in the kitchen. But on the other hand, it's something totally functional in life as well. And we all need it. And I love that kind of juxtaposition. So I do feel quite lucky to be in a food business. I don't think I could work in a business where I don't feel very strongly about what we sell. Like, I'm not interested in just selling what sells. I'm interested in sharing a passion with customers. The other thing I think about food is that, particularly in a business setting, it kind of makes you realise food is a serious business as well. You know, it is about a global system and it's influenced by government and by policies, and it starts with the way we farm and it finishes with our own, how food affects our health. As a food business, you know, in our own little way, we can just champion the system that we believe in, and I really like that as well.
Sarah, that's a magnificently full answer. And in it, I think we've got the framework of what we're going to talk about today. There's an awful lot to unpack there. But let's head straight to the beginning of the story of the company that you work for, because you mentioned there how important it is to you to work for an organization that you care about the things that you sell. And that wasn't always a case, I'm guessing, in your working life, because you haven't always been working for Westmorland or with Westmorland. So do you want to give us a little bit of an overview of how you got to where you are, and indeed how Westmorland got to where it was?
Well, I read French and Italian at university. I then went and worked in the city. So I worked in investment banking for Rothschild's Investment Bank. And I was then a headhunter in the city for a period of time. Then I came back and joined the family business. By then I'd met my now husband, and we then moved up north and started a life in Cumbria. So yeah, you know, the city is a very different environment and it works for lots of people. I don't think it would have worked for me in the long run, but it was great fun and it was fast paced. I learned to work hard. In its own way, I enjoyed it as well. It was a fun time, but I'm very glad to be in a business where you can put your own stamp on it and you can connect it with the things you feel strongly about. So I feel very lucky that I'm able to do that now. And then the business, my parents started just over 50 years ago. So mum and dad are hill farmers in Cumbria, just around Tebay. They married in the late 60s and the M6 was basically built through their farm. As it worked in those days, the government would identify where motorway service areas were going to go. So they actually identified just the point at which it went through my parents' farm as a site for a motorway service area. So I think it was serendipity in a way. My parents knew that if they were going to stay where they were going to have to do something outside of farming to sustain an income and a life, just like lots of farmers have to around our area. And they decided that they would have a go at bidding for a motorway service area. It was on their doorstep and it was an opportunity. So that is what they did. I think back in those days, so it's the late 1960s, it was the oil companies that bid for motorway service area sites. And the oil companies, I think, had very little interest in the back and beyond in Cumbria and Shap Fell and probably never really anticipated it would grow enough to be of any commercial interest to them. So I think my parents possibly were the only bidders and so they won.
Can I come back to that? Because you say it as if it's the most natural thing in the world. It seems like an extraordinary thing to say to yourself, well, I'm a farmer. Oh dear, there's a road running through my farm. Nothing I can do about it. Okay, let's do a motorway serviced area. It must have been a very steep learning curve to come from farming to creating a motorway service area.
I think so. And risky as well, actually. But, you know, they had to put their farm and their house at risk to build the business. But I think they knew they didn't have all the skills. My dad is a natural entrepreneur. So I think my dad would always have done something outside of farming. He would have always started a business of some sort and this just presented itself. But they went into partnership with a food retail business, the Burkitt family, who had a bakery chain of shops. That provided them with some of the skills in terms of hospitality and retail that they needed. So the four of them, there was Nicky and David Burkitt, and then my parents, they were in 50-50 partnership, had a very happy partnership for 35 years and set about building a small motorway service area with a couple of petrol pumps and a very small cafe and a little shop. That's how it started. I think the philosophy was probably set at the beginning because, you know, they didn't set out with a proposition as such. They just worked in the way that was natural to them. My dad, he knew the local builders and he knew what slate he liked and what stone he liked to work with. And they knew local food suppliers and my mum's a good cook. So they just pooled their resources and their knowledge, which was very much local, and created a shop and a cafe and a business that was a small version probably of what it is today.
So I suppose their sort of connection with the locale, which is something that we're going to come on to, I think, quite a bit, informed how their business grew.
Definitely. They did it the way they knew, which was, you know, being part of that local community.
Now, I've read something that your father talked about, the pressures, I guess, on agriculture, and that at the time that we're talking about here, late 60s, early 70s, I think he likened it to two other periods of real stress, which were, intriguingly to me, just after the Napoleonic Wars, I wasn't aware of, and after World War I. Well, I wonder, but we're again at another time of sort of deep agricultural stress. The importance of diversification, it seems to me, is one of the great stories of your business life and your parents' business life. It takes a lot of imagination, doesn't it, to be able to do that? Because agriculture and farming can seem to a lot of people like a very repetitive, traditional, ingrained kind of activity. And yet what's being asked of people is to countenance a massive change in their working lives, which must be enormously challenging, I would think.
And I think my dad would say, you know, we're in a hill farming area here where it has always been very difficult to rely on farming as a sole income. And farmers have often diversified in the past. I suppose mum and dad's diversification was one where the farmers, we still have the farm, but the farm has become a relatively small part of what they do and the business a much larger part of what they do. But I think, you know, a lot of what we do in the business, even now, we work with a lot of farmers, our own farm, but lots of other farmers as well. And a lot of what we do is try to bridge the gap between the produce and the customer. And I think where farmers can do that, it's a big advantage to them.
Is that something that's very specific to where you are? What I'm trying to understand and get to the bottom of is we hear a lot about the stresses of farming, of massive farms, and the pressure that are put on them by things like supermarkets. And we kind of think about all these things in big business terms, whereas the massive success of what you've put together is actually sort of bringing together a series of micro communities into one much stronger whole. Do you see that as a template for what can be achieved, I guess, spread out on a wider level? Or is this something that is a sort of happy coincidence of time and place specific to where you are?
Well, I think our way of working with farmers and small food craft producers is a really important cornerstone of our particular business. I think in the UK, the supermarkets have a stronghold that is greater than certainly most other European countries, and it's actually really hard to reverse that. So I think part of the difficult deal for farmers is the stronghold that supermarkets have over our food economy and over our consumer, and the farmers always get squeezed. I think our business is probably an example of, you know, where you can create your own system and connect a relatively large population to a whole host of, we work with about 400 local producers in our business and farmers, to a whole host of farmers and producers, and bring those two together in a way that wouldn't be able to happen without a business like ours in the middle. And that's, you know, it's a very big part of what we do. We're always looking for the tiny producers that are very often one-man bands. They've just started creating something. They're usually absolute mavericks. And we get them at that stage before they're seen everywhere. And we work with them and we grow together. So their success is our success and vice versa. And so, you know, we have lots of examples of, we started a business down in Gloucester 10 years ago. We have lots of examples of, you know, one-man businesses 10 years ago that are now actually much bigger thriving food businesses as a result of being able to work together. So, you know, it's a very satisfying way of looking at things, really. And there's a kind of mutual dependency, I guess, between us that we need each other. So we look after each other.
So in a strange kind of way, I say strange, there's nothing strange about it at all. But because I think, in a sense, I've got to make it clear to the listener that Tibay motorway service area is not what you might have in your mind. You know, it's not Leicester Forest East. It's not Eastern in Gordano. It isn't, you come in and you find a giant Burger King and you walk in and there's a series of concessions that you will be very familiar with from the high street, with everything marked up by about 40%. It is actually a kind of appointment to visit. I mean, I think Frank Skinner described it. Am I right in saying that he described it as, he said, if there is a road to heaven, then Tibay Services is on that road. It's where you stop on the way. Now, this is why I think we've got to, just for listeners, make them appreciate that we're talking about a very, well, I say very, there's no such thing as very, it's a unique proposition on Britain's roadways. People go to Tibay Services, whether they're driving from south to north or north to south for other purposes, do they not? It's like an appointment to visit. Was that in your parents' mind, and is that in your mind when you build this business? Or is it a kind of a happy byproduct of the way in which you've gone about creating it?
I think it started as a happy byproduct, but I think now we realise, you know, we went from a first generation to second generation business back in 2005. So my sister runs our farm and I run our business, and we work very closely together. All the stock from the farm comes into the business. I think now we realise that it's absolutely our USP and that we have to preserve it at all costs, because we're the smallest motorway service area business in our industry in the UK. It's a strange industry. There's just a handful of big players. They're all owned by private equity houses. They're corporate entities. They have a series of franchises in their motorway service areas. We're totally different. And I think in many ways, in order to compete with much bigger players, the only way we can do it is by being completely different and making sure every decision we take makes us more different from the other ones. So we don't have any franchises in our business. We just have a farm shop and a kitchen, and the kitchen are cafes, essentially. We just make the food ourselves. It's very simple farmhouse food, really. We create food, I would say, as close to what you would see in a good home kitchen as is possible in a commercial environment. So we work really hard to have what we would say are proper ingredients, proper kitchen cupboard ingredients in our food. And then our farm shops are very much about working with small, interesting farmers and food producers, and then our shops being a platform for the brilliant stuff they do. So very often, actually, we build our farm shops around what they do. You know, we have amazing gelato producers in all our three locations now. And so we built big gelato counters in our shops, and they sell like hotcakes even in November. We have this amazing producer, Hetty, who makes amazing brownies down in Gloucester. And we have a whole brownie table in our shop. So we find the gems and then we build a business around it, because we're there to celebrate what they do and they make our business successful. So it's very much that partnership. So we perpetuate our difference now, and we kind of celebrate that difference. And I think, you know, so often smaller businesses try and fight for their corner by trying to do the same as their competitors.
So how do you choose the people that you partner with? I mean, is part of your job sort of scouring the locality and finding new chefs, new producers? Is it? Because I mean, if so, that sounds like an enormous amount of fun as jobs go.
Yeah, I think it definitely is the best job in the business. It's not my job, sadly, because I'd love that job. We have a team of buyers who, I think it is needle in haystack stuff. You know, they're always trying to find the interesting upcoming producer that isn't seen in every farm shop, is doing something maverick and unique and wants to work with us. So quite often we'll do bespoke things together because it suits our business and we need to have things a certain size, or they need to be handheld, or they need to be at a particular price point. So very often we'll work together on ranges that are right for us and our customers, and we want people that are going to be very happy with that partnership. We can't and don't interfere with sort of the quality of what they do, but we might be able to help on logistics and transport and packaging and pricing advice and stuff like that. So we see it as long-term partnership, really.
A lot of what I read about you and a lot of what I've read of what you've said, what comes through very strongly is care for the people that you work with and care for the people who work for stroke with you within the family business. And you have an ethos, which I read. I can't remember it off the top of my head. Is it unfair of me to ask you to paraphrase or even describe what that exact ethos is?
I wouldn't risk reading it by memory either, just in case I forget a bit. But essentially, it's about knowing that there isn't one measure of success for a business. There's lots of measures of success. So we want our customers to love what we do. We don't just want them to buy what we sell. We want them to love what we do. We want to be a really good employer. We want to have a supply chain that is really well looked after. We want to be involved in our communities, and we want to look after our natural environment. And I think it's somehow an idea of circular benefit, I think, not of, I think sometimes people think a business makes money on the one hand, and then with the other hand, they can do some good with it. But I think business is much more circular than that. So if you look after your employees, they will create a great business for you. Or if you look after your supply chain, they'll look after you when times are really tough, like COVID. You know, our suppliers were absolutely amazing with us during COVID. And I think it's because probably of the relationship that we've had with them, or, you know, the community. If you look after your community and support initiatives there, they're more likely to support you when you're putting in for planning for a new project or whatever it might be. So it's an idea of kind of actually you help each other. It's less philanthropy and more circular benefit, I would say.
Is that in part because of the nature of the business? I mean, you're involved in a family business, which is, I'm expecting quite a different dynamic from a normal corporation as such. Are you able to describe for me what that difference is, and or at least how it manifests itself to you?
Well, I think family businesses, I mean, I'm a big fan of family businesses. You know, I think if you are a family business, you tend to know lots of other family businesses. I also work with Timpson. I'm a director at Timpson's, which is another fantastic family business that does loads of good stuff. I think the two differences with a family business, really. One is the time horizon. So if you think of a PLC or a private equity business, they will work to a time horizon of 5 years or less. So everything they do will be to that horizon, and they will either be exiting their business at that point, they'll be personally leaving, or they'll be selling the business, and the exit will be then. And so all the decisions they make are about optimizing that particular time frame. If you take a family business, is not thinking about next year, it's thinking about next generation. So my sister and I have 5 children between us, and we're thinking about how do we get this business in great shape for that next generation. And I think when you have a very different time horizon, so a 25-year time horizon, let's say, you make very different decisions as a result of it. So you'll take short-term detriment sometimes for long-term gain, whereas a short-term business will make a very different set of decisions. So I think that's one difference. I think the other difference with a family business is a family business has freedom, a freedom that other ownership models don't have, to define their own success. So other ownership models might say they can, but at the end of the day, there's usually a predominant financial imperative in other ownership models to deliver financially, and that trumps everything by some multiple. Whereas in a family business, I mean, I think in any business, any good business has absolute respect for the financial imperative. You know, it is the enabler for everything, but it's a means to an end. It's not necessarily the end in itself. So I think as a family business, you can decide what matters, and then you can make that happen. And that's a fantastic freedom, I think. And family businesses, for that reason, should be protected and encouraged to thrive, because they bring a lot, I think, to society.
There's a couple of things that instantly scream at me there, which is, you're almost describing what's wrong with the political cycle, or at least one of the challenges of a political cycle, which is that in a 5-year cycle, so much time is spent in trying to ensure that in that 5 years, you then reach an end point when you go back to the nation and say, this is what we've achieved, vote us in for another 5-year cycle, which is, I suppose, deleterious to longer term planning. Precisely in the organization that you hope would be interested in long-term planning, namely a government. And the other thing that leaps out at me is that families are very often, obviously, located in a specific place. They may spread further and wider, but as a general rule, you know, you associate a family with a certain area, you know, the aristocracy, the Duke of Norfolk, whatever. Is this something that drives your sense of responsibility to locality? Because you're that much more firmly rooted in the place where your business is.
Yeah, locality does, by default, it creates and is a community, isn't it? So it definitely holds you to account, and you're a known entity in that community, and yes, you care about your reputation. You have to care about your reputation. I think that matters, doesn't it? Because back to the sort of idea of circular benefit, your reputation matters for the success of your business and for any abilities you have to create positive impact. But I don't think it has to be just local community. I mean, I think a lot of businesses can have global communities so long as the thread is clear. You know, my husband's a surgeon. His small specialty sort of works across many communities, across many countries. It's still a community, and his reputation across those communities is still, you know, a very direct one. So I think it's the notion of being part of a community, local or otherwise, that really matters.
On that, because at the time of recording, I'll break the fourth wall ever so slightly for our listeners. At the time of recording, there is literally today is the day of the farmers' protests taking place in London. And because it's sort of seen, I'm paraphrasing here, as a kind of threat to family businesses and threat to local community. Can you appreciate that fear, that concern that is in the farming community and in, I guess, family businesses generally?
Yeah. So the march is, I might have been on the march had I not been doing this podcast today. My sister's on it. The march is the farming community, essentially, and some family businesses, but mainly the farming community protesting about the new inheritance tax change, which means that on the death of an owner of a farm or family business, 20% inheritance tax will have to be paid, whereas before, no inheritance tax had to be paid. And I have full sympathy with that notion. I mean, I think inheritance tax, the idea previous to this change, the idea of inheritance tax, in my mind, in this country, has always been right, that those who are protecting and growing their own personal wealth and investment should pay tax on that. But those who are making a wider contribution to society because they are employing people or because they are supporting a supply chain or because they are paying multiple taxes that businesses and farms do, should be protected from paying that inheritance tax because that protection allows them to perpetuate their contributions. So by introducing inheritance tax, it now jeopardizes the continuity of that contribution and that good work. So, you know, if you take a business or a farm worth £100 million, that means on change of ownership, if one generation dies, in passing over to the next generation, £20 million of that £100 million has to be paid in tax. And, you know, you'll know, and any of us will know that are involved in business or farms, nobody has £20 million or 20% of the value of their business in their back pocket to pay. So what will happen is it will break up the ownership of those family farms and businesses. So I think it's sad because going back to our conversation about the value of family businesses and farms, I think it will dilute that value because it will dilute family business and farms in this country. And I wouldn't like Rachel Reeves's job. I think she has a really, really difficult job. And I understand the pressure that she and her department must have had in making the decisions. But I wonder if she looked to other countries to see what their models of protection were. So take Germany, for example. The family business market in Germany is significant, hugely successful. It's the backbone of their economy and it's really well protected. And they have a system in Germany where when a business is passed from one generation to the next, so long as it's run in the same way for 7 years post-transfer, it is exempt from inheritance tax. And it's those sort of models that I think would have helped Rachel Reeves and her department very much in their thinking if they were really thinking about the output they wanted.
I suppose that just to provide a modicum of devil's advocacy, there's also an attempt to look at what might have been seen as an inheritance tax avoidance scheme where suddenly large tracts of land are bought up by people on the expectation that they weren't going to pay inheritance tax. And that is also presumably corrosive to the farming and agricultural community as well. I mean, I don't profess to know the answers to how you deal with that loophole, but there is, I guess, another side to it as well, isn't there, to what is trying to be achieved?
There absolutely is. And that's one of the problems with farms, isn't it? That land has been used as something of a loophole increasingly over the last decades for people that have made their money elsewhere and want to then protect the value of that in land. I don't know exactly what the answer is, but the answer has to be in being able to define what a working farm is as opposed to an investment farm. I haven't quite worked out what that definition is, but I'm sure someone cleverer than me would.
Now then, away from the thorny issue of how the Chancellor balances the books, which is probably for the rest is politics rather than Inspired Minds, but the future for Westmorland and for not just Tea Bay, but other service areas, I should say. You're very careful not to call them service stations, I notice. What is the future? Is there expansion or is the model slightly different?
The answer is we do want to grow because I think growth helps you get better at what you do. I think when you're in business, we all have a natural instinct to grow. I think the important thing is just not to grow for growth's sake. You grow because you're learning to do things better and in more interesting ways. So since Jane and I took on the business, we grew outside of Cumbria. We had a cluster of businesses in Cumbria, and then we built a motorway service station in Gloucestershire, and we also bought one and redeveloped it in Scotland as well, and we're now hopefully on our way to getting planning permission for one in Cheshire, just west of Manchester Airport on the M56. So with luck and a fair wind, that'll be our next project.
So is this something, because, you know, in the conversation we've been having here, your locality, the partners that you have that work with you, this isn't something that's so obviously easily rolloutable unless there's somebody else who's equally passionate, isn't there, about that locality, be it in Cheshire or Scotland or Gloucester. So how do you handle those particular challenges?
Yeah, it was a really interesting challenge for us, particularly when we moved down to Gloucester. So when we built Gloucester Services 10 years ago, you know, it employs 400 people and work with lots of local producers down there now. We scratched our heads at the time thinking, how do we have the roots that we have in Cumbria, how do we put them down in a new place like Gloucestershire that we're not part of and we don't farm there and we haven't grown up in that community? I think part of the reason Gloucester worked was because actually it was a social entrepreneur, a chap called Mark Gale, who brought the land opportunity to us in Gloucester. His motivation in bringing it to us is he wanted a sustainable income for his regeneration work in some of the deprived communities of Gloucester. And so we set up an equity partnership with him. As a result of that, 3 pence in every pound spent in our farm shops and kitchens down there goes directly into local community projects via his charity. So last year, that was £757,000, so a good chunk every year. And we have that agreement with Mark for the next 22 years. And so for him, it enables him to not worry about fundraising and to do great work and know he's got a sustainable income, which is pretty unique in the charity world, in his communities in Gloucester, which are our employment communities. It's where our employees work. And so back to the circular benefit thing of we're investing in communities there that we're recruiting out of, where we're finding our small producers and farmers, etc. It has helped us have roots and I suppose sort of some credibility down there that we want to be part of a community and that we want to make a difference down there. So yeah.
Now, Time's Winged Chariot has moved on, so I've got time for one last question, and it's a slightly frivolous one, I guess. It's about motorway service stations generally. The job that I do involves me going around the country quite a bit. A lot of people do that. You will find yourself in what sounds like a boring conversation, but it's always a very passionate one, which is often your least favourite motorway service station and your most favourite motorway service station. And people have an extraordinary amount of passion about this. I'm not going to call it inspiration as such, but they're passionate about it. They care. You know, some people will go berserk about Leicester Forest East. I mean, frequently Gloucester is the one that comes up the most, I have to say, because most of the people that I work with are in cricket and we don't go up quite as far, I have to say, as TBay. We'll pop into Gloucester and we'll actually make it a sort of thing. If you're going down towards Taunton, right, we're going to make sure we take that route to stop at Gloucester services, which is crazy. What is it? Is this a peculiarly English thing? Or is this perfectly natural that we have this thing about our favourite motorway service areas?
I don't know, but you're right. You know, everybody's got a view, haven't they? And they love talking about it. I mean, it's extraordinary how often motorway service areas come up on chat shows and radio shows and things. It's just because we always get the clips and it is really, really strange. I've never quite understood it. I think it must be something about people being in a totally different mindset when they're travelling and therefore kind of somehow seeing their motorway service areas stop in a different light because they're on a journey somewhere. But it is quite extraordinary that people are even bothered to have views about it, but they do.
Well, I have a theory, which I'm going to get off my chest now, which is that motorway service areas are basically an extrajudicial zone, that they're like walking into an embassy, because in every other part of your life, you curate it, you decide it. And even when you're in the car, you're choosing and you're deciding to go from one place to the other. You're choosing and deciding where you're going to get off. But the one thing you cannot choose and decide is who is in this motorway service area, because suddenly you are cheek by jowl with the entire melting pot of society.
You're so right. I mean, it's interesting from our perspective because we're in those motorway service areas the whole time. You know, we call it Mr. and Mrs. Great Britain. You have everybody in there. You've got people who are working, you've got people going on holiday, you've got HGV drivers, you've got caravanners, you've got stag and hen do's, you've got celebrities. You know, we get an extraordinary number of celebrities coming through our services. You get royalty, you get everybody eating in that motorway service area. And we rather like it because there's a very sort of leveling feel about seeing all these different people in a motorway service area. It's very democratic, which is lovely and sometimes amusing.
Well, Sarah, I am not remotely ashamed to admit that my favourite motorway service area is Gloucester. I have not visited TBay, but I will do in order to ensure that I can say for certain which of the two will be my favourite. But Sarah Dudding, thank you ever so much for being on Inspired Minds.
Thank you, Daniel.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Sarah Dunning. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms, and if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.
If you've enjoyed Rathbones Inspired Minds, please do check out Rathbones Inspired Sounds, the podcast on which Rathbones investment managers talk to household name entrepreneurs on their business enterprises, their journeys, and the road to success, available wherever you get your podcasts.
The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.